wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letteru.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Mr. Spiritual Babies. G'day, my friend.
Good evening, Jono.
Did you enjoy last week's program?
Oh, man, I did. You know what?
It was excellent.
Went to bed, and I felt salty.
You felt salty?
I did.
And you did an excellent job on the video, by the way. Well done.
It was very easy to do with such fantastic pictures.
Fantastic pictures. Again, the website is www.outreachjudaism.org. Outreachjudaism.org is the website where you will find Rabbi Tovia Singer's ever-so-challenging and in-depth Bible study entitled Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah? We're going to be talking a little bit about that, I think, today, if we get time. It's available in audio, DVD, and a hardcover study guide. Welcome back to the program, Aquaman, Rabbi Tovia Singer.
It's great to be back, guys. It's wonderful to be here. And the show couldn't have been that bad. Couldn't have been a disaster because you're having me back.
Yes.
I mean, it was a total disaster.
Now, speaking of shows that you seem to come back to, can we just do a plug for Israel National Radio for a second? Because on with Tamar Yonah, you do the TNT program. You're still doing that, right? You guys are still doing that on Israel National Radio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have Tamar, a wonderful young woman. We've been doing that show for more than a decade on Israel National Radio together, exploring the news, the events that are quickly unfolding before our eyes. I think prophetic. I mean, there are so many texts in the Jewish scriptures. I can't say that don't make sense, but now we can understand what they mean. Whereas 300 years ago, they were studying Ezekiel and Zechariah, and they had to be scratching their head and going, well, I know God is going to do this, but I have no clue how it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We now know.
We now know. We have the benefit of seeing how prophecies are being fulfilled, and you discuss some of those things on that program. So that's, now, correct me if I'm wrong, IsraelNationalRadio.com?
Yeah.
Okay. And you let everybody know, by the way, you do let everybody know when you are going on air. You can find Tovia Singer on Facebook. Yeah, you can look him up there, and you keep people up to date when you are going on the air. So it's a handy thing as well. Also on your Facebook page, you are letting people see some of the most spectacular photos that you were taking under the water. And these are some of the things that we discussed last week. We said we were going to return to Ezekiel chapter 47 this week. But before we do, do you have a featured little critter for us or creature to behold?
Yeah, there's one unusual creature that I have never shown publicly. This is the first, and it's a mantis shrimp. Now, that doesn't sound very exciting, but it's, first of all, very pretty to look at. Extraordinary colors. It has these eyes that move independently. It's considered to have the best vision of any creature on Earth. But that's not what makes it so astounding. The mantis shrimp, the one I photographed, it was a night dive in Indonesia, crawled out from under a rock, has a very unusual weapon. In fact, there's nothing else like it in the world. It has a claw that it could release at such high speed, literally faster than a bullet. It the claw explodes out, hits its prey at a speed of 23 meters per second.
23 meters a second?
23 meters per second, faster than a 22 caliber bullet. And it hits its prey, which is often a lobster or an oyster or any of these crustaceans, and literally smashes it to pieces. And then it just eats the inside. It's very, very powerful. This animal is so powerful. The claw shoots out at such speed. There is no creature in the world that can launch an appendage at that kind of speed. Is so powerful that you can't keep it in an ordinary aquarium. It's very colorful, very pretty, but you need bulletproof glass for the aquarium because it will smash through an aquarium's, the regular glass on an aquarium. So, and that's what it does. So it shoots out this bullet, but this bullet is its claw. It smashes into its prey. It blows its shell to pieces, and then it just devours the entire thing.
But that is unbelievable. Have you actually seen the claw in action? I mean, have you seen that happen?
No. It's you know, one of the things that is all divers crave to see, and maybe I'll put that up soon, but it's rare, is to actually witness what's called predation, to actually see to watch, to observe the actual event of how it's happening. So it's rare for that to occur within vision. And even if you get to see predation, things happen under the water in such a split second that unless your camera is right there locked in, like I happened to be when I had those two yellowtail snappers kissing, I just happened to have the camera right there, right on the money, and able to grab that money shot.
Wow. But
now, for scientists, this raised a very unusual question, because this mantis shrimp played a role in the war in Iraq for the coalition forces.
And what? Hang on a second. No. I've heard how Mossad trained the sharks to
you heard about that?
Yeah, to conduct shark attacks in on the Egyptian coast. Was that right?
Right, at Sharm. Right. That's the oceanic white tip that I photograph extensively in the southern part of the Red Sea. Mm-hmm. But you see, the problem is this. The problem for scientists was, okay, so it's able to launch this claw at a speed faster than a .22 caliber pistol or bullet. But the question is, of course, for every action, there's a reaction, meaning this is a relatively small animal. I mean, for a shrimp, it's big. It's about a foot long. But how does it absorb the shock? How does its body absorb the shock when it smashes an animal much larger than itself? How does its body has to then absorb that kind of shock? Why doesn't its claw simply smash its body to pieces by that kind of smack? I mean, how does it absorb that? If we took our fist and smashed, it can literally smash through rocks in order to create a cave for itself in a coral. But the question is, how does its body absorb that kind of the reaction? That's the big question.
So for every reaction, there has to be a reaction. If you fire a gun, you feel it, like as you say, 22, you've got a rifle, and you can feel it in the shoulder as the bullet is fired. Your shoulder absorbs that impact, right?
Right. Now, rifles are designed to recoil, have some sort of recoil in them, and that's why it's not as intense. But this fish, technically it's not a fish, but this creature is, what does it have? They examined it, the part where the claw touches the body, and what it has is this whole series of bone structure where one bone absorbs to the next bone, and spreads the punch that it receives back into a point where it almost feels nothing. So which means the structure with the is just outrageous. With the body is connected to this appendage. It has bone and bone and bone. I don't know if you've ever seen in Australia, but in the United States they have on the highways where they don't want you to hit one of the, like a toll booth. So they have these cones, like sort of things that if you hit it, one would just fly into the next neck and just absorb all the energy. Well, that's what these animals have. They have a fabulous system of bone structure. Each one fits in the other, and it spreads the energy back until by the time it hits the shrimp, it almost has no energy that's pushing against the shrimp.
That's amazing.
Like a row of mattresses, a shock absorber,
but each one fits in the other, and it's sort of each one sort of spreads a little bit for the next and just keeps absorbing it. It's a bone structure rather than soft tissue. So it's a bone structure that spreads, and there's bone after bone, structure after structure that simply absorbs the shock until finally, by the time it reaches the animal, there's almost no shock. And what they did was they were able to use this technology created by God from the master of the universe, from the mind of God, and produce bulletproof vests. Because that was the big challenge in coalition forces fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, is how do they produce a bulletproof vest that's lighter but is able to absorb the shock of the of a bullet? Mm. And they used the model of this structure in order to create vests that were lighter and are able to absorb the shock of getting hit by the bullet. So
that is unbelievable.
This thing actually has opened the world. It's an absolutely fascinating creature.
It's a fascinating creature, and Mr. Spiritual Babies, I mean, just looking at it, not only does it do these incredible things, but looking at it, it's spectacular. It looks like a rainbow.
I've got to say, yeah, if you have a 23 meters per second punch, you can look however you want.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's true. But our creator obviously made it look like it's... I mean, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, Tobia, when you... As a scuba diver, do you want to approach this thing with caution? I mean, being the size that we are, would it still have a go if it felt threatened?
Yeah, but, you know, there's a general rule in diving, and that is that you don't touch things. It's frowned upon. So, therefore, everything we're there to watch, not to touch. There are, you know, in Indonesia, there's probably maybe 3,000 species, so many of them you encounter... You have no idea what it is, and then you study it when you come back on board because there's a whole series of encyclopedias on these ships that you literally live on for a week or 2 weeks, and you study them, learn about them, but you certainly don't want to touch things under the water. The many of the animals have sort of a mucus around it that protects it, and by touching it, it removes that. So we generally don't touch stuff, except for like sharks. That's something that people like to handle, like to touch, because they have very unique skin texture.
You told us last week that you were riding sharks. You grab onto that dorsal fin, yeah, and off you go.
You can grab onto it, or and one of the sharks that's easy to find are the whale sharks. It's the largest fish in the world. They grow to a length of probably about 50 feet, about the size of a school bus. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you why, but it's clear that these animals like being around people. And you'll see many photographs or films on YouTube of people just holding onto the dorsal fin and just moving around and letting the shark take you. That shark, and there are not many, but that shark, for some reason, is very comfortable around human beings. Even if you don't go near it, it will come up to you. I was diving, and one came right under me and sort of saddled me, where I was suddenly sitting on top of it. And its dorsal fin is enormous. I mean, it may go up, I'm just guessing, maybe 3 feet in the air. So above the fish. Uh-huh. So you almost have no choice but to be dragged along with this thing. Incidentally, for those listeners who are not familiar with the whale shark, they don't have teeth in the typical way. They eat plankton and organic material. Mm-hmm. Easy to find if you want to dive with them, because they have because plankton eaters have a very specific migration trail, and therefore we know exactly where they're going to be at a specific time, because they obviously follow the food.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They follow the jet stream, right?
Well, so we know, for example, I wanted to dive with them. So this past August, I went out to Cancun. Well, it's actually a little island off of Cancun. And then we went down and just dived with them. It is mind-boggling because... that means no matter what you see in a video, and you can see many videos of whale sharks, nothing could prepare you for the size. The girth of it is something like it's something like a 737 girth. It's just you're just looking at it and you just cannot believe what you're seeing. It looks like something created in Disney. It just doesn't look real, but it is.
But it is, oh my goodness. And so, once again, isn't our creator awesome? I mean, just some of the... Now, you just coming back to this incredible shrimp, the eyes, you said that it has incredible vision, and I'm looking at the eyes. They look like they can, you know, look in different directions at once. Why is its vision so incredible?
The eyes, they have... their eyes are made up of basically six rows that carry about 16 different types of pigmentations, and they're able to pick up colors. They actually see in three dimensional because of the module, the makeup of the eyes. Each eye is made up of I think like 10,000 separate. It's called the omnitenda opposition type, which means the eye is designed so that it could perceive wavelengths that we can't see. It could see ultraviolet light in wavelengths that we cannot perceive, and it could spot spot things in a completely three-dimensional fashion. And because the eyes are spread apart quite far, and you'll notice that they're extended, so the eyes could move apart very far, and as a result, you know, we see in two different dimensions because our two eyes are apart. But theirs, in the ratio to the size of the body, are much further apart. They can perceive color variations that we could never perceive. It is regarded as probably there's probably no creature in the world that has better vision than this particular creature. It's an absolutely astounding.
What an incredible creature!
It could detect what's called circulatory polarizing light, things that we can't see. It's just an astounding creature, just mind-blowing. But it does smash hands. It smashes fingers. It's called the thumb smasher.
It's called the thumb smasher.
Yeah, it literally can blow your hand, and it can blow your finger in two parts.
So if you didn't know about it, you're down there and you didn't have the experience and you saw this thing and you went, oh, wow, look at this, it's so beautiful, and reached out your hand, you could, within seconds, be missing fingers.
Yeah, but let me first, one little point here. I grew up in a very traditional Orthodox home, and I never, you know, ate any kind of shellfish, obviously. But, you know, I always hear this, especially from Jews who don't keep kosher or didn't keep kosher. They tell me, the shrimp or lobster is the most delicious thing in the world. People go crazy. Lobster is so good. They wear special pajamas to wear it. They dip it in butter. To me, it looks like a big cockroach. I mean, frankly, there's nothing more disgusting than a lobster. It does. If I see a lobster, I want to call an exterminator. And not only that, they serve like the whole thing. It's not like they chop it up, you don't know what the heck it is. They serve the whole big, disgusting thing. So for me, if I was going to touch an animal, I would never touch one of these kind of shrimps or something like that. Because to me, it's just absolutely blah, absolutely outrageous. So I look at it, observe it, but I would never want to touch any kind of shellfish, any of these kinds of fish. But we don't really touch things. That's not really done. It's we're there to observe and to look at and feel very privileged to do that. But to touch, we don't touch animals. I mean, unless it's very unusual.
If you are going to play rock, paper, scissors with an animal, this wouldn't be the one to play with. Right? No.
You don't think it is a delicacy. So apparently there's a delicacy, of course, in China and Japan, where they eat everything, including their grandmothers. I don't know, they eat weird things there, but they eat this, you know, whatever. They are plentiful. They're found only in the area of what's called the Indo-Pacific, which is the area where the Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean meet. That's where you have the greatest biodiversity, not just under the waves. I'm sure your listeners, you know, read about a new animal, a new mammal that was found. It's usually going to be in a place like Indonesia. Aside from the fact that Indonesia is made up of some 3,000 islands, some of them, you know, just humans have never been there. So that's where they're finding all these outrageous variations in creatures.
As I was searching through Tovia's amazing pictures, and I was finding a little bit of film footage to throw in, I found out that cuttlefish can't see underneath them, but they react to the ground that's underneath them when they camouflage. So they're not camouflaging themselves to what they can see, they're camouflaging themselves to what they're sitting on. And as their eyes are on top of their body, nobody can understand how they camouflage themselves to what they're on.
Oh my goodness.
And they do it in the dark.
No.
Yeah, so they can put them into laboratory circumstances where they black out all natural light, they can put them onto a color, and they'll still camouflage themselves to what they're on, even though they can't physically see it. And even if there was light, they still can't see what they're on.
I've never, ever considered that before, and you've just totally blown my mind, because now I'm thinking, how do they register the colors and that they're engaging with? Toby, you must have an answer to that, surely.
No, it's done by a chemical reaction. I should just begin by saying that although when we speak about cuttlefish, which is an invertebrate, as being among the most intelligent invertebrate, they're not competing. You wouldn't have a cuttlefish do your tax return. So they're not that intelligent, you know. So what's happening is the color changes in its pigment is done by a reaction from reflective chemicals that are underneath its body that changes the pigment cells. And by the way, it's so tight on a cuttlefish that the variations take place in an area that's smaller than a square millimeter. Therefore, it's very, very exact. That would correspond to an area, that would correspond to about 359 dpi. It's incredible. So it's a biological reaction to the pigment that it's whatever it's on. The body responds, but the animal's not thinking about it. The animal's not going, okay, I'm here, let me do this. It's an automatic reaction, and it's almost involuntary where it does that automatically.
A computation. It doesn't know why it's doing it or that it's doing it. It's just doing it.
Blows my mind. My mind is blown. No, I never thought about that before. And then you just put that in my head like that? And I'm going to be thinking about that all day. That just absolutely, I've never thought about it like that before.
Yeah.
My goodness. We do have an awesome creator. We have to go to Ezekiel chapter 47 because we told the listeners we were going to do that. It's let me read it again. I'm going to read from 7 to 10. It says, when I returned, Ezekiel says, when I returned, there along the bank of the river were very many trees on one side and on the other. And he said to me, this water flows towards the eastern region, goes down into the valley, it enters the sea, and when it reaches the sea, its waters are healed. And it shall be that every living thing that moves, wherever the rivers go, will live, and there will be a great multitude of fish, a great multitude of fish, because these waters go there, for they shall be healed. And everything will live wherever it goes. It shall be that, I think last week I read, it shall be that scuba divers will dive in it. Now, I'm not adding to the text. Clearly, that's not there. I was just having a little bit of a joke. It says, it shall be that fishermen will stand by it from En Gedi to En Eglaim, and there will be places for spreading their nets, and the fish there will be the same kind of fish of the Great Sea. Now, I'm assuming that is the Mediterranean Sea, exceedingly many. Tobias Singer, what can you tell us about this passage?
Well, this is fantastic. Just for your listeners to understand, you could take the book of Ezekiel and divide it into three parts. We're in Ezekiel 47, which is the second to the last chapter. Mm-hmm. We are in the midst. We are swimming, excuse the pun, in messianic prophecy. Mm. The messianic segment of Ezekiel begins at chapter 34, and it just spins and spins and spins, Valley of Dry Bones, the War of Armageddon, or the War of the Nations coming up against Jerusalem, 38-39. The description of the third and final temple from 40 really till 46, and then it explodes at 47, describing how Jerusalem and Israel returned to a state of perfection, and 48 is outrageous. What we're now focusing on is the last segment, beginning essentially in Ezekiel 34 and moves all the way through 48. That is entirely messianic. And so these are all messianic passages, and they describe the Messiah quite vividly. He's discussed, he's called the Prince, and he is mentioned 17 times in these passages, which is very, very unusual. Now, when we get to Ezekiel chapter 40, we get to Ezekiel chapter 47, we're right now in the midst of the third temple. And in order to understand these passages, we have to look at the opening passage. The opening passages describe the water that's springing out from underneath the temple. We know what that water is, and in fact, it was discovered just in recent years. The water springs out directly from underneath the Holy of Holies, right from underneath the Temple Mount, and then it shoots down south. Just so people know what south is, if you're standing in front of the Western Wall, so you're facing east, so it just drops down to the right, which slopes all the way down into what's called the City of David. Mm-hmm. Those waters gush out of the Temple Mount itself and is poured down beautifully down the down that the southern entrance, and then keep flowing down into the City of David. Today, we can. One of the most popular sites that people go to is to walk knee deep in the waters that you are describing right now, and these are waters that emerge from the temple. Now, there is a mikveh that we know of that's been written about extensively. A mikveh means a place where people immerse themselves, which no one could find. No one has found since the first temple. And two brothers decided that they wanted to try to discover where this mikveh, this place of immersion is, where it goes so deep that it goes over your head. They wanted to find out where this was. So one brother actually tied a rope around the other. He went beneath the water, and of course he had a signal for how many tugs, and then found the, what's called the Shiloach, and that's the place where King Solomon was anointed when King David was on his deathbed. That's where kings were anointed, and it was all discovered. So today, it's a fabulous area of archaeology. Today, one can go see it there. I personally immersed in that mikveh, in that area where you go, you know, it's knee deep, but if you find that right spot, it's all the way taller than a human being. That also is thought to be the place, to be the place where Jeremiah hid the Ark of the Covenant, although we can't be sure. That is the most likely area where it's hidden. So right there we have the flowing waters that go right down the south. Now, this all ties together because during the festival of Sukkot, the festival of tabernacles, that's when instead of the wine libation on the altar, there was a water libation that was poured on the altar. And that's where the water was carried up from that area. And of course, that all ties together with Zechariah 14, because it tells us that in those days, and at the end of days, the nations that will choose the God of Israel, together with the Jewish people, will celebrate the festival of Sukkot, the festival of tabernacles. Mm-hmm. So it all ties together. The water, which is poured on the altar during the Sukkot, which represents mercy, the Gentiles who choose the God of Israel, as opposed to those who come to war against it, they're what's called Gog u'Magog, and the word Gog in Hebrew means a roof. Mm-hmm. That's what the word Gog means, is a roof. So the people of the roof, which is very odd, but in reality it makes all the sense in the world. There are two kinds of people: those who trust in the roof. That means in a man-made concrete hardened cover shelter, and those who don't trust in the roof, in something of this world, but they trust in the clouds of heaven. They trust in God's glory, and those are the two opposing forces. And that's why in Daniel 7:13, it describes the Messiah coming on the clouds of heaven to those who are faithful. Why is he coming on the clouds of heaven? Because it's those who are faithful trust in the clouds, not in the roof. So you have the people of the clouds versus the people of the roof who trust in this world. And therefore, in Zechariah 14, what do we discover? That Jew and Gentile together worship the one God of Israel, because that's the essence of the Messianic age. And what do? They go into a sukkah, into that booth. And what is the essence of that sukkah? The schach, the covering, which represents the clouds of glory. So what we have here is this is all mercy. This is all in those who trust. And these are the great waters that stream down from the Temple Mount.
That's amazing. So what you're telling me, sorry to interrupt you, but I'm trying to wrap my brain around this. You're telling me that they have detected a great reservoir of water under the Temple Mount, and they believe this is what will be the water, the living waters that flow from out from underneath the temple all the way down to the Dead Sea. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's not they think. It is. It's not they think. It's rushing, raging water. I encourage the listeners, when you're in Israel, go to what's called the City of David, which is just south. If you walk out of what's called Dung Gate, which is the normal, one of the major entrances. It's the one right off the side of the Western Wall. And you go down to the City of David, which is around the corner. You will find there what's called Hezekiah's Tunnels.
Hezekiah's Tunnels,
were what was used to bring water up into Jerusalem during the siege of Assyria. You can walk knee-deep. This is a big tour. This is not like... So people walk through there. Thousands of people go through there every day. And then there's this one place, only one place, that is large enough for a... This is where the high priest went... into a, it's not carved into, it's just a place where it just goes right down. It's not, it's about 7 feet tall, where you just immerse yourself in the mikvah. And this was the mikvah of the high priest. He was discovered by two brothers, those who know the City of David. And incidentally, you can go on a website for the City of David. I don't know the name of the website, but his name is, the man who really was the one who liberated the City of David. His name is Davidala. He's a very unusual man. It's his two sons who now live on the Mount of Olives, all the way on top of the small Jewish community. These two brothers, one went underneath with a rope tied to his leg because he was going in the water underneath stones, and there was a signal they had where two tugs, get me out of here, one tug, I'm fine, and he kept going under rock until he found it. Today, this is seen by thousands of people a day. The water gushes down from the Holy of Holies, from a spring there, and just shoots down south, right through the Kidron Valley, south until the Dead Sea. This is
so
not
when my wife Hani, when she went to Israel, she did she went through Hezekiah's tunnel. She said it was one of the greatest highlights of her trip. We did go there in March, and we went to the City of David and on the tour with Keith Johnson and myself. And we did go to the City of David. We didn't go into Hezekiah's tunnel because we weren't suitably attired. But maybe this coming March we may do that. Now I think because I'm 6'5", Toby. Or I don't know. I think I'm going to have to sort of crouch down to get through there.
No, you won't. You won't. It's not a tunnel. It's quite tall.
Is it really?
Yeah, that means it's tall. It's just a very narrow crevice in the rock. When I say no, any person could fit through, but there's no height restriction. I mean, I don't recall offhand how tall it is, but
it's way
up there. We may have to add it to the list.
We may have to add it to the list on the tour to go through Hezekiah's tunnel. That's happening, by the way, dear listeners, in March. There are still seats available on that tour, and you can look into that by going to truth2u.org, truth2u.org, clicking on the picture of Keith and myself on the right-hand side. It'll take you to the details.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned this as a messianic, as full of messianic prophecies, from particularly from 40 and on to the end. Can we clarify that a bit? Because obviously Ezekiel is about the restoration of Jerusalem, the temple, the priesthood, and the Messiah and the king.
In fact, the prince at the end of, and I think many of your listeners will find this very strange and striking, but you have the sin sacrifice returning. Christians struggle with this a little bit because in the Hebrews and Romans, it would appear that the sacrifice system would come to an end. But in fact, it is returning. The sin sacrifice is returning, which is a sacrifice for unintentional sins. In fact, if you look at Ezekiel 45, verse 20, 21, 22, you'll see there that, in fact, the prince, the Messiah, brings a sin offering on behalf of himself and the people.
He does.
For sins that are committed unintentionally. Naturally, in a Jewish model, this makes complete sense. People still will be human, will make mistakes of errors in the Messianic age, but there will be no rebellion in the Messianic age. So we see in the Ezekiel 45 sacrifices, sin offerings, the Messiah himself will bring. And why he's bringing it is because of unintentional sins. We see in Isaiah 46, verse 16 and 17, that the Messiah is going to have children, a family, sons.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it there as well. And here we see the world coming to a state of perfection. But the waters, it's interesting, in the old days, the people who deny the Bible, who are opponents of Scripture, you say, well, where are Hezekiah's tunnels that are discussed extensively where water was brought in? And then they discovered it. The British, of course, took the plaque, and it's sitting in the British Museum, so they have an alternative one. They created a replica of it. But the tunnels are there, the water that explodes, I mean, really explodes out of that area, you can walk right through it. You should have water shoes on. It's a little cold, but it's absolutely brilliant.
So you need, you need to wear your Crocs, or you need to wear some flip flops or something like that.
You need water shoes to walk. I mean, to, you know, you don't want to wear patent leather, you know, tuxedo shoes.
No, that would be a good idea. Now, you mentioned it does refer to the prince, and you said that's in reference to the Messiah. And if we go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, we see that the everlasting kingship, if you like, the kingdom, is through David and Solomon. Is that fair?
That's correct.
But there are some people, Rabbi, who say that how can that be the case? Because we know that Solomon's reign came to an end, that there was the division, that there was the exile, that there's no one sitting on the throne at the moment. Therefore, how can it be a prophecy about Solomon? What, how would you answer that?
Well, first of all, it's very clear that it is. I mean, that's not open to debate, because it says the one who will build this temple in my name. So we know quite clearly it is Solomon. Mm. In fact, the kings that followed, whether it was Rehoboam, and you go further on to Uzziah, Yotam, they were all descendants of King Solomon. So, in fact, we know that. The reason people are confused about Solomon is that in Kings, we have this disaster with Solomon in chapter 11. You know, I don't know about you guys. I'm sure we all love Solomon, you know, but there's an ambiguity of what happens to him, because he married women that would bring idolatry into the temple. But we have very clearly in Chronicles showing that it is Solomon that the line goes through. The promise is made very clearly that he will be to me a son, I will be to him a father. Mm. And it's not that he won't make mistakes. So the text, again, these are not my words, but the text clearly states that if he sins, I will punish him with the rod of men, but I will not remove the kingship from him as I did from his predecessor. Now, these texts, these promises, just like we have in Genesis 49, verse 10, does not mean there would never be an epic where there would be no king. What it's saying is if there was going to be a king, or all legitimate kings would have to come from this line. So, for instance, there was a period of Babylonian exile, 70 years. Obviously, was no king, and there was no king during the Second Temple period. There was no king except for the Maccabees. We just celebrate Hanukkah, but the Maccabees who reigned, the Maccabean period reigned for about 103 years.
The Hashmonean dynasty.
Yeah, but they actually inappropriately assigned for themselves, not the father, but as they went on, they assigned for themselves a position of kingship, which was inappropriate, and therefore they suffered, and there's no one left of their descendants today. But they were Kohanim, they were priests, and therefore had no right to the kingship.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. So when we read in, just returning to Ezekiel chapter 37, which you mentioned, verse 24 and on, it says, David my servant shall be king over them, and they shall have one shepherd, and they shall also walk in my judgments and obey my statutes and do them, and then they shall dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob my servant, where your fathers dwelt, and they shall dwell there, they, their children, and their children's children forever. My servant David shall be their prince forever. Now, when it talks about David being their prince forever, is it talking about a descendant of David, or is it?
It means that it is an heir to the covenant that God made with King David. It doesn't mean that King David will somehow, like, what do they have in the Hindus?
Reincarnate.
He's not going to reincarnation of David. What it means is that this individual, who is not only a descendant of King David, but will sit on the throne of David as a result of the promise that God made to King David. And incidentally, what we see there in the text is, and it's important to remember, is that all Christians agree that these are messianic passages, and this text is referring to the Messiah. There is no alternative reading of that. Interestingly, it says there that this is clearly talking about the Messiah in the Messianic age. It says that in that time, they will have one shepherd, and they will follow the mitzvahs, the commandments of the Torah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the prince that we read there in chapter 37 is a descendant of David through Solomon, as we see in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12 and on. Therefore, when we get to Ezekiel 45, as you mentioned, we see the prince offering a sin sacrifice. We're definitely talking about the Messiah, the king.
Right, that's correct.
Okay. So that, I suppose that is a, I mean, Christianity, I suppose, goes into damage control when they see that, because in that theology, how does a prince have to make, how does the Messiah have to make a sin sacrifice? In fact, if I go to my, because I'm reading from my New King James, listeners know that I read from the New King James Study Bible, the Nelson Study Bible. What I have here in, and this is the note on 44 verse 3, where the prince is introduced. In that study note, it says the prince. The identity of this prince is unknown. The Hebrew term does not always mean a king or a member of royalty. It is not the Messiah. Get that right. It is not the Messiah, since 45 verse 22 indicates that this leader must make a sin offering for himself.
What they're doing is, I'm not saying this in a derisive way, but they're walking it backwards in physically and spiritually. They're going, I have to end up at this goal, and the goal is the Messiah, Jesus, can't bring a sin sacrifice on behalf of himself and others. There is a complete division among commentators of who the prince is, but this is perfect, because the ones who say this is not the Messiah, which is a very, would be, I mean, who else could this be? We saw there David, the prince, who will lead over them, right, in 37. That's clearly speaking about the Messiah. If you go back in your commentary, I don't have it in front of me, I'm sure it's going to say that. So what they do is they can't have Jesus bring the sin sacrifice, because after all, Jesus was sinless. The Messiah is sinless, so that's not possible. So therefore, they have to either reinterpret what it says earlier or just say, we don't really know who it is. But isn't that strange? I mean, here we have from 36 to 47, we have 17 times this one individual who's so important, he's able to go into Aries' temple, no one else is the most prominent individual, and it's not the Messiah? I mean, who really
is?
No,
it's amazing. So, and you're absolutely right when you say, if I go back to 37 and verse 24 and on, if I look at the study notes there in my New King James Study Bible, it says, the title David my servant refers to the Messiah and King who would come from David's line to save Israel, and it references 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 8 to 16. But when you go a couple of chapters further, well, this can't possibly be him.
Right, but at least they're being honest. That means they're saying the reason it can't be him is not because the text doesn't suggest it. It can't be him, because we're starting off with the postulate that we got to believe in Jesus, and we have to believe that Jesus was sinless and couldn't possibly bring an animal sacrifice. And he was saying the animal sacrificial system really was never efficacious, never really worked. Hebrews 9:22, Hebrews 10:4-5-6, and so on. So they're working it backwards. Instead of saying, okay, let's figure out who this could possibly be, they're not. They're saying we have to start off with the fact that Jesus is the Messiah. He died for our sins, and he's the final sacrifice for all times, Hebrews 10:18. And therefore, we have to reinterpret Ezekiel based on Hebrews, which is...
So, you know,
but the question is, why are there sacrifices returning no matter who it is? I mean, let's just concede everything. It's obvious the prince is the Messiah, but let's say we ignore that. Why would a sin sacrifice be returning in the Messianic age, no matter who you let's say we say the prince is the janitor. Why would he be bringing a sin sacrifice? And incidentally, you can't say it's a lot of the folks, like not Matthew Henry, but I forget the name, but a lot of premillennial dispensators say, well, it's a more a Schofield, it's a memorial to what happened in the past. But if actually, if you go to the text, you'll see there in 20 through 23 that, in fact, that sin offering was brought for what? For unintentional sins. Sins that were committed unintentionally. They're not brought as a memorial to anything.
Mm. So, Rabbi, this is problematic for Christian theology, obviously. But if we, and you mentioned Paul, and Paul mentions that Jesus was born according to the flesh of the line of David. And if we go to Matthew chapter 1, if we jump into the New Testament, we go to Matthew chapter 1, verse 11, I think verse 6, it does tell us that Jesus was born in the line of David and Solomon. So we're winning there, right? I mean, is he still in the running?
Well, you know, Matthew opens with the genealogy, and it's very clear in Matthew 1 that it starts with, this is the first verse, this is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. So Matthew is setting, we don't know who wrote Matthew, but whoever wrote it, now it's called Matthew, is trying to demonstrate that Jesus was eligible to be the Messiah, because here's a genealogy. It's a 41-generation genealogy. It's very problematic. There are, in order to get his genealogy going and to get 14, 14, 14, names have to be stripped from that genealogy. But setting that aside, Look, only two books in the New Testament, or two writers in the New Testament, claim that Jesus was born of a virgin. That's Matthew and Luke. Each of them have a very different plot device to get them born of a virgin in get him born of a virgin in Bethlehem. But the key point is, if Jesus was born of a virgin, then the genealogy is irrelevant, because that genealogy is the genealogy of Joseph, and therefore, in according to, if he's born of a virgin, Joseph is not related to him. Now, some Christians say, well, Luke is the genealogy of Mary. It's not in the text at all. That doesn't exist. They just have to come up with that. In fact, you look at Luke 1:27, it's Joseph that was in the line of David, not Mary. So therefore, these genealogies are completely irrelevant once you insert
the birth. Luke doesn't have Solomon. So we're at a loss there. We can't use Luke. It's Matthew that has David and Solomon in the genealogy.
Matthew's genealogy is also quite impossible. There's too few generations. If you look from Jeconia was, let's say, died in the year about 612 BCE. So from 612 BCE, Matthew assigns 13 generations till Jesus. Talking about over 600 years, to have 13 generations, that would mean the average generation of person was having a baby around the age of 50 years old. So there's so many names that are stripped out, even if we were to concede, because obviously the last segment are unknown names, it would be impossible to cover 600 years and 13 generations, particularly in a time when the average human lifespan was maybe 25, 26 years old. Mm-hmm. So it's impossible on many different levels. Luke's genealogy in chapter 3 is at least more extensive, with 56 generations. So in a sense, it's more plausible. Matthew's genealogy is impossible.
Well, you mentioned Jeconia, or Kenia, as some people say, and that takes us back to Jeremiah chapter 22, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Jeremiah 20, Jeconia only reigned for 3 months. He was referred to as the Jewish Caligula. He was so evil, so wicked, that Jeremiah cursed him that none of his seed would ever sit on the throne of David. In fact, the person who will rule after him is Jehoiachin instead of Jehoiachin. It's an M at the end instead of an N or a mem. That's his uncle, it's his father's brother, in order to bypass the curse. And then it continues down there to Tzidkiyahu. So therefore, the curse creates a staggering problem, because if, in fact, this is the genealogy of Jesus, then he's not eligible to be the Messiah because of the curse on Jeconia. Now, I debated a Christian once, man, I really respect, and I raised this issue, and he responded, and Josh McDowell does the same thing in his book, Evidence of the Man's Verdict, and says, that's the reason why you need a virgin birth, because if Jesus wasn't born of a virgin, he would have been the descendant of Jeconia, and therefore ineligible to be the Messiah. But if, in fact, that's the case, then why introduce the genealogy altogether? That's not the genealogy of Jesus.
It goes back and forth, but the verse that you're referring to is Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 30. Thus says the Lord, write this man down as childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for none of his descendants shall prosper sitting on the throne of David and ruling anymore in Judah. But I've had a lot of people say to me, what about King Zerubbabel?
The answer is that there is no such thing as King Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, who is one of two leaders, Zerubbabel and Yeshua ben Yehotzadak, are the two leaders that restore the Second Temple. And the answer is Zerubbabel wasn't a king. He was a governor.
So what you're saying is he never sat on the throne of David?
No, he couldn't. And therefore, he's only a governor. The word King Zerubbabel doesn't exist, never happened in history. There were no kings during the Second Temple period. So he's a direct descendant of but he never actually sits. So we actually see it employed. No child of Jehoiachin ever sits on the throne. It's his uncle, it's his nephew, but never in descendant. And Zerubbabel, which literally that name means seated in Babylon, is not a king. He's a governor. I should mention the fact there is a Jewish tradition. Christians, strangely, although Christians don't believe in the Talmud, an oral tradition, they do appeal to an oral tradition on this thing. It really gets very interesting. So what happens, strangely, is that ordinarily Christians speak of the Talmud derisively, but if it will save them, rescue them from a problem, from a conundrum, they'll appeal to it in a second. So sophisticated Christians will say, but the Talmud says he was forgiven. That creates two monumental problems for them if they want to appeal to the Talmud. The first problem is unbelievable, and that is, therefore, Jeconia was able to atone for his sin without shedding blood. He was able to atone for his sin, using Christian terms, by his own works, by something that he had done. And number two is, we have here that the Bible says one thing. Scripturally, Jeconia is never restored. None of his children ever sit on the throne of David. So that means that if you have an oral tradition that even that contradicts what the plain text says, these Christians will say, we'll go with the oral tradition, even though it contradicts completely what the written text says, which is astounding.
And this is the case in Manasseh as well, the son of Hezekiah, who was so incredibly evil. He was exiled, and in exile he repented without being at the temple, without sacrifice. He repented and was restored and returned to the land. I mean, there too is equally a problem for them. But this is what the Talmud is claiming happened for Jeconiah. And this is what you're saying some Christians will lean on in order to get around the problem of the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1. But then once you do that, again, you are building a case against the virgin birth. So it goes around and around.
Well, the virgin birth is a latecomer to Christianity. The earliest Christians didn't believe in a virgin birth. In the book of Mark, the earliest of the four Gospels, were introduced to Jesus as an adult. There's no mention of Jesus being where he's born. There's no mention of, I mean, Mark didn't simply forget to mention that part, but the letters of Paul are much older than the Gospels. First Thessalonians being the oldest, from base probably about 49. I mean, Paul didn't just forget to mention that part. It's all as a conversion of Jews to Christianity, and it then may not been called that, but we'll just call Christianity, will basically end, and then it's almost all Gentiles. They're going to introduce ideas that are very well known in the pagan world, such as the virgin birth. That's why we only find it in Matthew and Luke. In fact, the notion that Jesus was born in Bethlehem is only mentioned by Matthew and Luke. Very different descriptions of a nativity narrative, but they both are going to have him born of a virgin. John is so late that his birth really is relatively unimportant, because John's prologue, John 1 through 18, is now going to have Jesus presenting Jesus as never before, as basically pre-existent.
So John attempts to bypass these problems that appear in the genealogy. So this is fascinating. Mr. Spiritual Babies, you're absolutely silent. What's coming through your mind?
Well, like the listeners, I'm just sitting back and soaking it all up. I have to say, I've gone through the Christian tradition as a Baptist in the UK. It's not quite it's a little bit different to maybe there in the States, and they don't tend to go towards the virgin birth in a Baptist church as heavily as I've seen in some other movements. And I think that's because they're trying to separate themselves a little bit from the kind of iconography that you find in Catholic churches.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting though, because as Tobias says, it's clearly a latecomer, or so it would appear, because Paul, who was written vastly before, decades before the Gospels, Paul says that Jesus is a descendant of David according to the flesh, and so he has no problem with that. It's not and it's strange, Tobias, that what you have is the genealogies, and in both Gospels that have some kind of genealogy to tie together what Paul has claimed, also then seem to want to negate that by adding the virgin birth story. It's a fascinating problem to try and solve. And for many, many Christians, when I mention things like this, they never knew there was a problem there. They'd never given it a second thought. They didn't realize that they had to play mastermind to make it all work. And once you solve one problem, you've got another that you have to deal with. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, once you make one, if you have a perfect system, Torah Hashem Tumimah, the Torah of God is perfect. If you take any perfect system and remove one piece, it has a ripple effect, which means you start spinning in circles. The virgin birth is an embellishment. I mean, you take Mark, which is the least embellished of the Gospels. Not only do you have no mention of birth, as I mentioned, you're first introduced to Jesus at his baptism, where Jesus finds out he's the Son of God at that moment. Remember, there's a different heavenly voice in Mark and Matthew. In Mark, the voice says, "You are my son, and on this day I begot you." So the voice is speaking to Jesus, informing him of his new status at the baptism. Look carefully at Matthew. It's different, because as you go later in time, Jesus becomes becomes the Son of God at an earlier stage in his career. In Matthew, the voice says something that's slightly different. This is my Son in whom I am well pleased. Which means the voice now is not addressing Jesus. In Matthew, Jesus knows he's the Son of God because he was born of a virgin. So who, this is my Son. Jesus is now third person. He's informing the audience that is there around. John is so late, and has Jesus as pre-existent, that John, there is no baptism. Jesus is never baptized.
That's fascinating. That's awesome. Well, I reckon we have... That's a lot to chew on, and I think we better leave that with the listeners, but it certainly gives you an insight, some clarification, coming back to the latter chapters of Ezekiel, as to who this may be, or maybe more precisely, who it isn't. So there's something for the listeners to chew on, and I'm sure that the listeners will then have many, many questions. Please, Rabbi, would you be happy to answer listeners' questions?
Yeah, in fact, if you'd like, if you'd like, in the next show, I'm just saying this, and we're doing this on air. if you want to, you're welcome to have listeners write in questions, and then but don't tell them to me, and then on air we can address them if you'd like to go down that road.
I think that would be a wonderful thing, because undoubtedly there will be many, many questions after this program. And if I could just make one request, if we could have a featured creature, how's that? I want an underwater feature creature every single program. If we could do that, one of your personal photos that you have taken and an explanation, as you just did with that beautiful lobster or whatever.
The mantis shrimp mantis.
Non-kosher, guys, stay away from me.
Crusher.
I'm about to put that up on Facebook, that image and an explanation of it. It's really quite astonishing.
Tovia Singer is the Facebook page. You'll find him there, and we'll put a link at the bottom of this page. Thank you so much, Rabbi Tovia Singer, for coming back on the program. Mr. Spiritual Babies, thank you, my friend, and until next week, where we can discuss some of the listeners' questions and a new feature creature. I'm going to have to practice that. Good heavens, that's a tongue twister. In the meantime, dear listeners... OutreachJudaism.org is the website of Rabbi Tovia Singer. OutreachJudaism.org, a plethora of resources found there. And until next week, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.